Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. Chairman, I come before the committee with no agenda. I have no platform. Judges are not politicians who can promise to do certain things in exchange for votes.
The Senate opened confirmation hearings Monday for John Roberts to become the nation's 17th Chief Justice. We'll play excerpts. And on the heels of Hurricane Katrina, where have all the prisoners gone?
The water rose until it reached chest level. The men that were in the gymnasium were able to break the windows out of the gymnasium, and they literally swam out of that room to escape from the prison. But the men that were in the holding cells could not get out.
Then, more than 100,000 Hondurans live in the greater New Orleans area. Some are double survivors. They survived Hurricane Mitch, then Hurricane Katrina. Now they're afraid of the U.S. government.
Buscando los indocumentados, y a mí me molestó eso porque le dije que no le hiciera caso, porque no es verdad.
They say there's a lot of people that have left in the shelters because somebody came and told them that the immigration were looking for them, and they were the border patrols here, and so they left, a lot of them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate confirmation hearings for John Roberts to become Chief Justice of the United States have begun. Today, Roberts will undergo a day of questioning before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Monday, Roberts vowed he has no political agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I come before the committee with no agenda. I have no platform. Judges are not politicians who can promise to do certain things in exchange for votes. I have no agenda, but I do have a commitment. If I am confirmed, I will confront every case with an open mind. I will fully and fairly analyze the legal arguments that are presented. I will be open to the considered views of my colleagues on the bench. And I will decide every case based on the record, according to the rule of law, without fear or favor, to the best of my ability.
If confirmed, the 50-year-old Roberts will become the youngest Chief Justice in more than 200 years. We'll have more on the Senate hearing in a few minutes. In New Orleans, relief workers have found the bodies of 45 people inside the Memorial Medical Center. Hospital officials said at least some of the victims died while waiting to be evacuated. Also on Monday, Michael Brown resigned as director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He'd come under intense criticism for FEMA's slow response. Brown's resignation caught President Bush by surprise. When a reporter asked him for comment, Bush said, quote, "Maybe you know something I don't know." 10 days earlier, Bush publicly praised Brown, saying, quote, "Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job." David Paulison will now take temporary control of FEMA. He served as the administrator of the U.S. Fire Administration as a former fire chief of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Department. Meanwhile, a new USA Today poll has found 72% of African Americans feel President Bush does not care about the country's black population. 67% of white respondents says he does. President Bush denies accusations that race played any role in the government's handling of the disaster. He spoke to reporters in New Orleans Monday.
You know, my attitude is this: the storm didn't discriminate, and neither will the recovery effort. When those Coast Guard choppers, many of whom were first on the scene, were pulling people off roofs, they didn't check the color of a person's skin. They wanted to save lives.
In other hurricane news, the Times-Picayune is reporting FEMA is preparing to build dozens of mobile home communities around Louisiana to house up to 200,000 people for up to 5 years. One FEMA official said, quote, "It may not be quite on the scale of building the pyramids, but it's close. This is big. We've never done anything like this." In some cases, FEMA will effectively create new towns with as many as 25,000 mobile homes, complete with their own security force, utilities, government services, and even schools. FEMA officials denied these temporary towns would become tent cities or refugee camps. FEMA has already gathered more than 6,000 trailers and mobile homes in Louisiana and has ordered 100,000 more. More environmental concerns are being raised in the Gulf Coast region. The magazine Solid Waste and Recycling reports New Orleans may be facing a dramatic pollution issue related to a 95-acre toxic landfill in downtown New Orleans that's still underwater. The landfill's federally registered Superfund site and is considered a highly contaminated site requiring cleanup and containment. The flood has increased the chances that the toxic waste in the landfill could leach out and contaminate the surrounding area. Two Superfund sites in neighboring Mississippi may also have sustained water damage. According to the Washington Post, the flooded Superfund sites contain a range of contaminants that include heavy metals linked to increased cancer risk and developmental problems, as well as other carcinogens. In Iraq, at least 200 people are dead in the city of Tal Afar after U.S. and Iraqi forces launched a major assault on the northern city over the weekend. On Monday, the Iraqi Red Crescent Society sent in aid for families displaced by 3 days of bombardment. It was the largest attack since the siege of Fallujah. U.S. officials originally portrayed the bombing as essential to stop the flow of foreign fighters from Syria, but the Washington Post reports the targets were largely Sunni Turkmen. According to the Post, the Kurdish militia known as the Peshmerga, not the actual Iraqi army, led the assault. Meanwhile, the U.S. is denying an accusation that the military used toxic gases in the attack. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi reportedly posted an audio message online claiming the U.S. was using some type of chemical weapons in the city. Lawyers for Texas death row prisoner Francis Newton have asked Texas Governor Rick Perry for a 30-day stay to try to prove that authorities erred in linking her to a presumed murder weapon. Newton is scheduled to be executed Wednesday night. She's set to become the first African-American woman executed in Texas since Reconstruction. Meanwhile, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals refused Monday to stop the execution, and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles voted unanimously not to recommend that Perry commute the sentence to life in prison. This is Frances Newton.
Well, I cope with the support that I have, the love of my family and my friends that I have, the love that I have for my husband and my children, and just knowing my own innocence, that helps a lot, you know. I cope knowing that I have people fighting for me, that believing in me and believing that the right thing will be done.
That was Frances Newton speaking from death row. She's scheduled to die tomorrow. In Haiti, two journalists have been released after spending the weekend in jail. Independent journalist Kevin Pena and Jean Rasteel of the Associated Press were arrested while covering a police raid on a church led by the jailed priest Gerard Jean-Just. Pena is a regular contributor to the Pacifica program Flashpoints. The Miami Herald is reporting the U.S.-funded National Endowment for Democracy has agreed to give a leading opposition group in Venezuela over $100,000 in funding. The group helped lead the effort to oust Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez through a recall referendum last year. The recall failed. Backers of Chavez have long accused the U.S. of helping to facilitate his overthrow by financially backing opposition groups. The NED says the money will be used to strengthen democracy in the country. In labor news, the Union Unite Here may quit the AFL-CIO as early as this week. Unite Here represents more than 450,000 U.S. hotel, casino, and restaurant workers. In July, the AFL-CIO suffered a major split when the Service Employees International Union, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and the United Food and Commercial Workers all pulled out of the federation. And Israeli soldiers have officially pulled out of the Gaza Strip, ending 38 years of military occupation there. Israel retains control over the territory's air and sea space and, at least temporarily, all its borders. Thousands of Palestinians poured across the Egyptian border to reunite with relatives and to buy goods, including cigarettes. Egyptian forces on Monday fatally shot one Palestinian during the rush across the border. And that's some of the news. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate opened confirmation hearings Monday for John Roberts to become the nation's 17th Chief Justice. If confirmed, Roberts would be the youngest Chief Justice in more than 200 years, and he would be positioned to lead the court for decades. A federal appeals court judge for the past 2 years, Roberts served in the Republican administrations of President Ronald Reagan and the first President George Bush. Monday's hearing was devoted solely to opening statements from the 18 members in the Senate Judiciary Committee, the three senators chosen to introduce Roberts, and from the nominee himself. As the afternoon came to a close, Roberts was sworn in by Committee Chair Arlen Specter. Speaking without notes, he gave a brief opening statement in which he outlined his view of the judiciary. This is Roberts.
Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around. Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules. But it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire. Judges have to have the humility to recognize that they operate within a system of precedent shaped by other judges equally striving to live up to the judicial oath. And judges have to have the modesty to be open in the decisional process to the considered views of their colleagues on the bench. Mr. Chairman, when I worked in the Department of Justice in the office of the Solicitor General, it was my job to argue cases for the United States before the Supreme Court. I always found it very moving to stand before the justices and say, I speak for my country. But it was after I left the department and began arguing cases against the United States that I fully appreciated the importance of the Supreme Court in our constitutional system. Here was the United States, the most powerful entity in the world, aligned against my client. And yet all I had to do was convince the court that I was right on the law and the government was wrong, and all that power and might would recede in deference to the rule of law. That is a remarkable thing. It is what we mean when we say that we are a government of laws and not of men. It is that rule of law that protects the rights and liberties of all Americans. It is the envy of the world, because without the rule of law, any rights are meaningless. President Ronald Reagan used to speak of the Soviet Constitution, and he noted that it purported to grant wonderful rights of all sorts to people. But those rights were empty promises, because that system did not have an independent judiciary to uphold the rule of law and enforce those rights. We do, because of the wisdom of our founders and the sacrifices of our heroes over the generations to make their vision a reality. Mr. Chairman, I come before the committee with no agenda. I have no platform. Judges are not politicians who can promise to do certain things in exchange for votes. I have no agenda. But I do have a commitment. If I am confirmed, I will confront every case with an open mind. I will fully and fairly analyze the legal arguments that are presented. I will be open to the considered views of my colleagues on the bench. And I will decide every case based on the record, according to the rule of law, without fear or favor, to the best of my ability. And I will remember that it's my job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat. Senators Lugar and Bayh talked of my boyhood back home in Indiana. I think all of us retain from the days of our youth certain enduring images. For me, those images are of the endless fields of Indiana, stretching to the horizon, punctuated only by an isolated silo or a barn. And as I grew older, those endless fields came to represent for me the limitless possibilities of our great land. Growing up, I never imagined that I would be here, in this historic room, nominated to be the Chief Justice. But now that I am here, I recall those endless fields with their promise of infinite possibilities. And that memory inspires in me a very profound commitment. If I am confirmed, I will be vigilant to protect the independence and integrity of the Supreme Court, and I will work to ensure that it upholds the rule of law and safeguards those liberties that make this land one of endless possibilities for all Americans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I look forward to your questions.
Judge John Roberts speaking on the opening day of his confirmation hearing to be the country's 17th Chief Justice. Roberts' comments came after the 18 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, 10 Republicans, 8 Democrats, delivered their opening statements. While lawmakers from both sides of the aisle praised Roberts' credentials, Democrats challenged his commitment to civil rights, women's rights. They cited documents stemming from Roberts' work as a government lawyer under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Democrats repeatedly said all questions are fair game. They promised to use the nearly week-long hearings to ask Roberts about a number of issues, including abortion, civil rights, and the powers of the presidency and Congress. This is Delaware Senator Joseph Biden.
Like the founders, I believe our Constitution is as big and as grand and as great as its people. Our constitutional journey did not stop with women being barred from being lawyers, with 10-year-olds working in coal mines, or black kids forced into different schools than white kids. Just because in the Constitution, nowhere does it mention sex discrimination, child labor, segregation. It doesn't mention it. Our constitutional journey did not stop then, and it must not stop now, Judge. And we'll be faced with equally consequential decisions in the 21st century. Can a microscopic tag be implanted in a person's body to track his every movement? There's actual discussion about that. You will rule on that, mark my words, before your tenure is over. Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior? You will rule on that. And, Judge, I need to know whether you will be a justice who believes that the constitutional journey must continue to speak to these consequential decisions, or that we've gone far enough in protecting against government intrusion into our autonomy, into the most personal decisions we make. Judge, that's why this is a critical moment. There are elected officials in this government, such as Mr. DeLay, a fine, honorable, patriotic man, and others, who have been unsuccessful at implementing their agenda in the elected branches. So they've now poured their energies, as the left would if it were different, they've now poured their energies and resources into trying to change the court's view of the Constitution. And now they have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, the filling of two Supreme Court vacancies, one of which is the chief and the other is for Associate Justice, the first time in 75 years. Judge, I believe with every fiber in my being that their view of the Constitution and where the country should be taken would be disaster for our people. Like most Americans, I believe the Constitution recognizes the general right to privacy. I believe a woman's right to be nationally and vigorously protected exists. I believe that federal government must act as a shield to protect the powerless against the economic interests of this country. And I believe the federal government should stamp out discrimination wherever it occurs. And I believe the Constitution inspires and empowers us to achieve these great goals. Judge, if I look only at what you've said and written, as used to happen in the past, I would have to vote no. You dismiss the constitutional protection of privacy as, quote, a so-called right. You derided agencies like the Securities Exchange Commission that combat corporate misconduct as constitutional anomalies, quote. And you dismiss gender discrimination as, quote, and I quote, merely a perceived problem. This is your chance, Judge, to explain what you meant by what you have said and what you have written. That's what I said when I was chairman. That's what this is about. The Constitution provides for one democratic moment, Judge, one democratic moment before a lifetime of judicial independence. This is that moment. And when the people of the United States are entitled to know as much as they can about the person we are entrusting with and safeguarding our future and the future of our children and our grandchildren. Judge, as you know, and we talked about, this is that moment, and this is what this hearing is about. I thank you.
Democratic Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware delivering his opening statement at the confirmation hearing of John Roberts to be Chief Justice in the Supreme Court. While Democrats asserted all questions during the hearing are fair game, Republicans used the opening day to encourage Roberts not to answer questions about his views on controversial topics. This is South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
What is the standard for a senator to confirm a Supreme Court nominee, whatever the senator wants it to be? And really, that's the way it should be. But there should be some goals, in my opinion. The way we conduct ourselves, one of the goals we should have is to make sure we don't run good people away from wanting to be a judge. I don't know what it's like to sit at home and turn on the television and watch a commercial about you in the presence of your wife and your kids that say some pretty unflattering things about you. That's just not a problem you faced. I'm sure Democratic nominees have faced the same type problem. We shouldn't, in our standard, trying to come up with a standard, invalidate election. The president won. The president told us what he's going to do, and he did it. He picked a strict constructionist to be on the Supreme Court. If anybody's surprised, they weren't listening to the last campaign. Roe v. Wade. It divides America. If you believe in polling, most Americans would like to see the decision stand, even though we're divided 50-50 on the idea of abortion on demand. My good friend from California has expressed a view about Roe v. Wade, which I completely understand and respect. I can just tell you, Judge Roberts, there are plenty of women in South Carolina who have an opposite view about abortion. If we were to make our votes, base our votes on that one principle, Justice Ginsburg would not be Justice Ginsburg. In her writing, she embraced the idea of federal funding for abortion. She indicated that an abortion right was based on the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. I dare say that 90% of the Republican caucus is pro-life. I dare say that 90% of the Democratic caucus is pro-choice. Justice Ginsburg got 96 votes, even though she expressed a view of the federal government's role in abortion that I completely disagree with, and I think most conservatives disagree with. There was a time, not too long ago, Judge Roberts, where it was about the way you lived your life, how you conducted yourself, what kind of lawyer you were, what kind of man or woman you were, not whether you had an allegiance to a specific case or a particular cause. Let's get back to those days. Let's get back to the days where the Ginsburgs and the Scalias can be pushed and pressed, but they can be honored for their commitment to the law and the way they lived their life. Let's get back to the good old days where we understood that what we were looking for was well-qualified people to sit on the highest court of the land, not political clones of our own philosophy.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham at the opening day of hearings for Judge John Roberts to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we continue with the confirmation hearings, and then we go down to New Orleans. More than 100,000 Hondurans live in the area. What has happened to them after surviving not only Hurricane Katrina, but before that, the devastating Hurricane Mitch in Honduras? And then, where have all the prisoners gone on the heels of the hurricane? Stay with us. That a sudden sun discloses, for the people here are singing bread and roses. Marching, marching, we battle to four men, for they are women's children. Let the mother speak again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve Bread and Roses here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with the opening day of John Roberts' confirmation hearing. President Bush nominated John Roberts despite pressure from Republicans and even from his own wife, Laura Bush, that he should name a woman to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was considered a swing vote on the closely divided court. Roberts is a solidly conservative Republican, has come under criticism for his work and views on abortion. Many Democrats say they intend to question Judge Roberts on his views of the right to privacy, the basis for the Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion, which he once seemed to dismiss as a so-called right. In Monday's hearing, it was Senator Dianne Feinstein of California who made the strongest comments of the day on reproductive rights.
Now, as the only woman on this committee, I believe I have an additional role in evaluating nominees for the Supreme Court. And that's to see if the hard-earned autonomy of women is protected. Like any population, women enjoy diverse opinions, beliefs, political affiliations, priorities, and values. And we share a history of having to fight for many of the rights and opportunities that young American women now take so much for granted. I think they don't really recall that during the early years of the United States, women actually had very few rights and privileges. In most states, women were not allowed to enter into contracts, to act as executor of an estate. They had limited inheritance and child custody rights. It actually wasn't until 1839 that a woman could own property separate from her husband, when Mississippi passed the Married Woman's Property Act. It wasn't until the 19th century that women began working outside their homes in large numbers. Most often, women were employed as teachers or nurses and in textile mills and garment shops. As women entered into the workforce, we had to fight our way into non-traditional fields, medicine, law, business, and yes, even politics. The American Medical Association was founded in 1846, but it barred women for 69 years from membership until 1915. The American Bar Association was founded in 1876, but it barred women and did not admit them until 1918. That's 42 years later. And it wasn't until 1920 when, after a very hard fight, women won the right to vote, not even 100 years ago. By virtue of our accomplishments and our history, women have a perspective, I think, that's been recognized as unique and valuable. With the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the court loses the important perspective she brought as a woman and the deciding vote in a number of critical cases. For me, and I said this to you privately, and I'll say more about it in my time on questions, one of the most important issues that needs to be addressed by you is the constitutional right to privacy. I'm concerned by a trend on the court to limit this right and thereby to curtail the autonomy that we have fought for and achieved, in this case, over just simply controlling our own reproductive system, rather than having some politicians do it for us. It would be very difficult, and I said this to you privately and I said it publicly, for me to vote to confirm someone whom I knew would overturn Roe v. Wade. Because I remember, and many of the young women here don't, what it was like when abortion was illegal in America. As a college student at Stanford, I watched the passing of the plate to collect money so a young woman could go to Tijuana for a back alley abortion. I knew a young woman who killed herself because she was pregnant. And in the 1960s then, as a member of the California Women's Board of Terms and Parole, when California had what was called the indeterminate sentence law, I actually sentenced women who committed abortions to prison terms. I saw the morbidity. I saw the injuries they caused. And I don't want to go back to those days. How the court decides future cases could determine whether both the beginning of life and the end of life decisions remain private, or whether individuals could be subject to government intrusion or perhaps the risk of prison.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein delivering her opening remarks at Monday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. Many Republicans on the panel came with a set of procedural talking points aimed at encouraging Roberts not to answer the Democrats' questions about his views on controversial issues before the court. This is Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley.
A fundamental principle of our country is that the majority has a legitimate right to govern. This approach hardly means that the courts are less energetic in protecting individual rights, but the words of the Constitution constrain judges every bit as much as they control legislators, executives, and our citizens. Otherwise, we're no longer a nation of law, but a nation of politicians dressed in judges' robes. During my tenure in the Senate, I participated in a number of these Supreme Court nomination hearings, and I believe it's 9 to date. I'm hopeful that we will see a dignified confirmation process that will not degenerate into what we saw during the Bork and Thomas hearings. Rather, we need to see the same level of civility as we saw during the O'Connor, Ginsburg's, and Breyer hearings. Moreover, I'm hoping that we won't see a badgering of a nominee about how he'll rule on specific cases and possible issues that will or may come before the court. That has been the practice, as you know, in the past. And let me remind my colleagues that Justices Ginsburg and Breyer refused to answer questions on how they would rule on cases during the confirmation hearings. The fact is that no senator has the right to insist on his or her own issue-by-issue philosophy or seek commitments from nominees on specific litmus test questions likely to come before that court. To do so is to give in to the liberal interest groups that only want judges who will do their political bidding from the bench, regardless of what is required by the law and the Constitution. The result is, then, loss of independence for the Supreme Court and a lessening of our government's checks and balances. Some have suggested that since you've been nominated now to be Chief Justice, you deserve even more scrutiny than before when you were just nominated for associate. Some are saying that we should prolong the hearings and turn over even more stones than we've already turned over thus far. Well, the Chief Justice has been described as first among equals. The plain truth is that there really isn't anything substantively different in your role, and your vote will count just the same as other justices of the court. So my own questioning and analysis of your qualifications will not really be much different from your previous appointment. But it is true that the Chief Justice has additional duties as the head of the federal judiciary. The Chief Justice has to be someone who has a good management style, who can run the trains on time, and who can foster collegiality in the court. So, Judge Robert, I think that since you've appeared before the court 39 times to argue cases on appeal, and that the current justices know and respect you, that bodes very well in terms of your smoothly transitioning into the court, into the new role now of Chief Justice. I congratulate you.
Senator Chuck Grassley, it's Senator Grassley speaking at the opening day of the hearings for John Roberts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll bring you excerpts of these hearings throughout the week. Democracy Now! Broadcasts in over 350 stations around the country on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. We are podcasting there, and our headlines are in Spanish, both audio and transcript, at our website. As we turn now to Hurricane Katrina, just coming back from Louisiana. It's estimated that 120,000 Hondurans live in the New Orleans area. Many were refugees from Hurricane Mitch, which devastated Honduras in 1998, killing up to 10,000 people. Others came to the area to work at Louisiana's ports and fisheries. Now in the aftermath of the Hurricane Katrina, this community is on the move again. Though the U.S. granted temporary legal status for the Honduran victims of Mitch, others are undocumented. They fear deportation. It's unclear what the U.S. government will do about their citizen status now. According to an article in the Interpress Service, Honduran ambassador to the United States, Norman Garcia, lamented that the offers of food, medical, and logistics support made by Latin American and Caribbean governments have been turned down. Mexico's consul in Houston told IPS undocumented migrants live in a state of terror. Democracy Now! Traveled to Louisiana this weekend, and we spoke with some of the Honduran survivors just out of New Orleans as the community of Gonzales. First, we met with Honduran consular agent Jorge Vitanza in a local mall parking lot.
We have all the people from Honduras all spread out in the area, and we're trying right now to find out where they are, giving them assistance with the information on how to get help from FEMA, and if they don't apply, to look other ways to help them out. We already have people from our government coming in this last week and gave us some money to help out the people that don't have anywhere to go.
Are Hondurans who come here, I don't think most people realize how large the Honduran community is in the greater New Orleans area. Can you talk about it?
Yes, we know that there are about 82,000 people from Honduras in New Orleans, plus the people that don't have documentation. We can go about talking about 100,000.
Are they afraid to go into some of the shelters?
They are. We have talked to them, and they're going at night, sleeping, and coming out in the morning, early in the morning, because they're afraid that they're going to be deported, which that's not true. At this moment, they're not doing that.
Do you have any assurances from the Department of Homeland Security?
Yes, yes. They have sent a letter telling us that right now there are no deportation of the victims that are here in this area.
Jorge Vitanza, the Honduran consular agent, speaking to us just outside Gonzales, Louisiana. He then took us over to the Healing Place Church in Gonzales, where we met with Honduran Katrina refugees, some double survivors from Hurricane Mitch in Honduras. This is a woman who identified herself as Santa.
Sí. Han habido muchos, y yo les dije que no se fueran porque alguien les anduvo diciendo a los indocumentados. A mí me dijeron que andaba la migración buscando a los indocumentados, y a mí me molestó eso porque le dije que no les hiciera caso, porque no es verdad.
They say there's a lot of people that have left in the shelters because somebody came and told them that the immigration were looking for them, and they were the border patrols here, and so they left, a lot of them.
Border Patrol came here?
No. Que andaba en la
what,
calle.
They were on the street. That's what somebody came and tell them, and they were afraid. But nobody have come here.
Santa speaking to us at a shelter in Gonzales called Healing Place. This is just outside of New Orleans. We also spoke to the pastor of the Healing Place in Gonzales. Her name is Melissa Gutierrez, and she talked about FEMA and Katrina victims trying to get hurricane relief.
Well, it varies. Some days there are like 90, maybe 75. We've had 150, 120. It just kind of varies every day.
How many Hondurans are here?
I really can't tell you. I don't have that number exactly, but we have a lot of Hondurans. Mm-hmm. I'm not real sure, maybe close to 20, mm-hmm. 25 maybe.
And what about their immigration status? Are they concerned about coming to a shelter and not having the documents?
I think we have, they're not all undocumented. We have some that are, you know, undocumented, but then we have those who have been here for years and have their residency and all. And so there, we have a little bit of both, you know, that stress of just not knowing and not being able to get the relief from the government. And then there's others who are fine because they know that something's coming up ahead. So we're kind of dealing with both situations.
If someone is not documented, can they apply for help?
I believe right now they can apply for food stamps. FEMA that cannot apply for FEMA.
They can't?
No.
How do you know that?
Because I had a lady bring me a paper, and they have to provide a Social Security.
For FEMA?
For FEMA.
Melissa Gutierrez, pastor of the Healing Place Church in Gonzales. And then she brought over a young woman named Mirta Flores, who had not only survived Katrina, but she had survived Hurricane Mitch. We'll go to her after break. John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the Honduran refugees of Hurricane Katrina, over 100,000 Hondurans live in the New Orleans area. It's estimated about 10% of the population there, a story that is not very well known outside of the area. And some of the survivors are also survivors of Hurricane Mitch, 1998, in Honduras, believed to have killed something like 10,000 people in Honduras. A number of people came to this country, among them Mirta Flores, who recently came here. She told her story to us at the Healing Place Church. She was translated by the pastor of the church as she talked about surviving Hurricanes Katrina and Mitch.
Bueno. Ya son dos veces ya con esto de que pues nosotros cuando nosotros casi nos tocó, nosotros solo salimos del lago, entonces ahí solo salimos de ahí y entonces ahí agarramos esa parte de ese huracán porque cuando estábamos ahí se puso bien oscuro y aquel gran viento y el carro se estremecía porque nosotros andábamos en un carro de un brasileño que nos dio ray.
Okay, she said that they were actually near the lake, and they had not left yet from where they were living. And actually, they really got a lot of the hurricane, and but they were just barely able to get out. But they were in a car with a Brazilian friend.
Mm-hmm. Pues, le agradezco mucho a ustedes también que nos están visitando. Y espero de que nos ayuden en algo nosotros. Nosotros no tenemos papeles, somos ilegales, pero esperamos en Dios y ustedes que nos ayuden, porque también tenemos 5 niños en Honduras y nosotros nos hemos venido para acá porque sabemos que allá no es muy, el sueldo es muy, no es muy bueno y por eso.
We have come here from Honduras, and we have 5 children, and we're here to just make a better living. And we just want to thank you. I just want to thank you all also for coming to see us, and some of you have come to visit us, and we're just thankful for that because we can see that people care for us. Also, we just ask that you help us because we are here without legal papers, and we just don't really know what's up ahead. And so we need help.
Yo le pedí a mi Dios que nos dejara porque nosotros digamos que nos tocó bastante ese huracán. Yo le pedí a mi Dios que nos dejara porque teníamos 5 niños en Honduras.
And I asked God with all my heart to please keep us safe because we have 5 children in Honduras.
When did you come to the United States?
¿Cuándo llegaste a los Estados Unidos?
En junio.
In June.
Did you survive Hurricane Mitch in Honduras?
¿Cómo sobreviviste el huracán Mitch allá en Honduras?
Nosotros lo salimos de ahí para otra aldea.
We left that the community we lived in, and we went to another area.
So they are Hurricane Mitch survivors.
So, así que ustedes sí pasaron por el huracán Mitch.
Sí, también sufrimos mucho también.
At that very time, we also suffered very much.
What happened?
¿Qué fue lo que sucedió allá?
Se llenó las casas de agua, todas las casas llenaron de agua y todas las cosas, todo se arruinó ahí adentro de las casas porque todo eso lo agarró ahí donde estábamos.
Well, all the houses were filled with water and everything that was inside was pretty much destroyed.
So how do you feel to come here and go through this again?
Así que cómo te sientes venir aquí y tener que pasar por lo mismo.
Pues me siento a veces que hasta me dan ganas de irme con la misma, pero con la misma digo, yo tengo mis hijos y no me da para mantenerlos allá porque ustedes saben que la pobreza de Honduras también lo hace venirse para acá, pero con la misma, si Dios quiere, vamos a tratar de, a ver, si Dios quiere, tenemos trabajo y entonces vamos a lograr de hacer irnos o no sé, ¿verdad? Solo Dios sabe.
She says, really, only God really knows, but that I would really like sometimes just have the feeling to just get up and leave and go back to my country. But when I think about my five children, I think that really there they have no future because of the poverty that we live in there. And so I just feel and I believe in my God that he's going to help us to get through this and that eventually we'll be able to get a job in the future.
Mirta Flores, a survivor of Hurricane Mitch and Katrina, in the Healing Place shelter. She was translated by Melissa Gutierrez, who's pastor of the Healing Place Church in Gonzales, Louisiana. Well, finding Honduran refugees was difficult because they're so afraid of being caught by U.S. Border Patrol, whether or not they're documented. And think about it. Who has documents after the hurricane? But finding what happened to prisoners in New Orleans is even more difficult. A makeshift prison has been set up in the Greyhound bus and train station in downtown New Orleans. It's being run by Burl Kane, the warden of the Angola prison, which is the largest prison in this country, as well as prison guards from New York. The nearby prison, the Orleans Jail, was flooded after the hurricane. What happened to the prisoners there and in other parish prisons in New Orleans? Well, we spent a long time trying to find out. Yesterday, a writ of habeas corpus was filed in Louisiana for an accounting of the prisoners. One woman who has been working tirelessly since the hurricane and flood is Phyllis Mann. She's a defense attorney in Alexandria, Louisiana. She went to the Angola prison, where it's estimated something like 500 women were brought to this men's prison after the hurricane. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Phyllis Mann. Can you talk about what happened in Angola?
I and two other female attorneys went to interview. We interviewed 199 of the 499 women who are currently being housed at our male maximum security prison at Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. Everyone calls it Angola. And we spent the entire day in the dormitory where these women are being housed. There have never been women housed at Angola before. These women were moved to Angola from women's facilities in Orleans Parish due to the flooding there. And among the women that are being held there, I met with a 49-year-old woman who is a citizen of Jamaica, who had been arrested on August 16th because she overstayed her visa. But before her deportation could occur, the hurricane came. And so now it has been almost a month, and she would happily return to Jamaica. In fact, what she expressed to me today was not only would she happily return, but she just doesn't have any future plans ever to come back to America again in light of her experiences. That she was housed in a building that they call Conchetta, which is houses women in Orleans Parish and is part of the Orleans Parish system, and was there when the waters began to rise. And she, along with all these other women, initially were moved from the first floor up to higher floors. And then as those flooded, they had to be evacuated out. And they were taken by boat from the Orleans Parish prisons. That many of them walked for hours through chest high water. Some were able to be boated out, and then they got to the Causeway Bridge where they were left waiting for buses. And then from there, they were brought to Angola. And these women are being housed in dormitories that hold 100 women. When they were in Orleans, they were several days without any food or water. Ultimately, they had to... they put water in trash cans when the water stopped operating at the prison. And then they were subsequently told, don't drink the water from the trash cans. Now we're afraid it's contaminated. And these are women, by and large, just like the woman from Jamaica, who have, it could be you or I met with another woman who had failed to pay a fine. She was also arrested on August 16th. And because she failed to pay a fine, is sitting in our maximum security prison. And we don't know when we're going to be able to get these women out of jail. There was another woman who was arrested for sleeping by the ferry. She has a $600 bond, and she's been in jail since August 3rd. But because the records for people who are arrested in Orleans Parish are maintained by the Orleans Parish Sheriff. Until those records can be reconstructed, we can't get these women out of jail.
Phyllis Mann, can you talk about the men and what happened in the Orleans jail?
Sure. Last week I interviewed 200 men who had been moved to Rapides Parish, to the Sheriff's Jail here from Orleans Parish. And two of the men in particular told me a story that just was almost unbelievable to me. These men were federal detainees, meaning that they had been arrested on federal charges and were being held in the local jail. And they had originally been housed in OPP, which is actually stands for Old Parish Prison, there in Orleans on the federal tier. And as the water began rising, they were moved from that floor up to a higher floor. And ultimately, they were placed by the guards in a gymnasium area in the facility where they were locked in. Once the guards placed them there, they did not see any guards again. Some of the men that were on the same floor where they were not in this open gymnasium area. They were in holding cells. And as the water began rising, it got higher and higher, and they'd been there about a day and a half with no food or water, and they had not seen any guards. And the water rose until it reached chest level. The men that were in the gymnasium were able to break the windows out of the gymnasium, and they literally swam out of that room to escape from the prison, but the men that were in the holding cells could not get out. And the men that I spoke to that were able to free themselves were very, very certain that the other men in those holding cells have drowned. These men that that were able to free themselves literally, you know, swam out of the building and then found a guard to turn themselves into. And they were then placed on buses and brought from Orleans to Hunt Correctional Center, where they were given blankets and they basically slept on the hillside for another day and into the following day when they were placed on buses and brought here to Rapides Parish. And again, one of the many problems that we're facing, and that I don't know we have a solution to, is until we can reconstruct the records of the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Department, we will not even know who was housed in the various Orleans Parish facilities. We're not going to know how many inmates did not make it out of those facilities.
Phyllis Mann, what were these men charged with that you interviewed?
The two men that told me the story were both charged with federal offenses. They were federal drug offenses. But the men that as they were being relocated to higher floors in Orleans Parish Prison, not everyone who was relocated there was charged with a serious crime. Many of these men, just like the women that I talked to today, were arrested on very minor charges. They may have been arrested for public drunk or possession of drug paraphernalia, which could be something as minor as a roach clip. Some of them were charged with trespass. Some of them were on probation and had missed a court date or had missed a drug court hearing, and were in jail for 7 days to sort of get their attention. Well, my Lord, we've gotten their attention now.
So what's going to happen to them?
Ultimately, we'll get this all sorted out. There are lawyers all over the state, criminal defense lawyers, who are going to all of these facilities. There are 35 facilities that we are aware of all over the state of Louisiana, where over 8,500 people from Orleans jails were evacuated. And we're literally having to go in and meet with these people one by one to figure out when they got arrested, why they were in jail, whether they've been convicted or whether they were waiting for trial, whether it was a misdemeanor or a felony. I understand that the computers from the Orleans Parish Criminal Sheriff's Office were retrieved from Orleans on Friday. And their information technology people have been working to try to get as much information off of those computers as possible. And eventually what will happen is that they're going to start matching the information that they can recover from those computers to the information that we've been getting by going in and interviewing these people one by one so that we can figure out where they're supposed to be. I'd say a good half of them are not supposed to be in jail at all. They've served whatever sentence they had received and should be released. But until we can figure that out, they're sitting there.
Some haven't even been sentenced at all.
Many of them not sentenced at all. Many of them not even convicted. They are people who, like all American citizens, when they're arrested, are presumed innocent until proven guilty, and they've not even had an opportunity to go to court.
Phyllis Mann, how did the prisoners reach their families?
We have a hotline number that has been established through Hunt Correctional Center. Families can call into these numbers. It's area code 225, and the two numbers are 342-5935 or 342-3998. If they had a loved one who was in jail in any of the affected parishes, St. Bernard, Orleans, Jefferson, or Plaquemine, they can call into those numbers and leave a message about where they currently are, where their loved one can call to reach them, and they can also find out from Hunt Correctional Center where their loved one is now being housed. We do finally have a complete list of where everyone was evacuated to, so families can call in for that information.
Phyllis Mann, thank you very much for being with us. Phyllis Mann, a defense attorney in Alexandria, Louisiana. A writ of habeas corpus has been filed to find out, well, get a counting of the prisoners, believe something like 8,000 of them. Where are they? Have they been moved? Did they survive? What has happened? That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, go to our website at democracynow.org. If you'd like to hear or see it, we're podcasting there at democracynow.org. You can see photographs and video as well. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Uri Galette, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.